WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This year, Lieutenant Kelly Flynn, the Air Force's first female bomber pilot, resigned from the military. She accepted a general discharge instead of facing a court-martial for having an intimate relationship with a man who was married to an enlisted woman, lying to a superior about the relationship, and disobeying orders to stop seeing the man. She also faced charges of fraternization as a result of an earlier encounter with a military man who was not in her line of command. Flynn faced a possible sentence of 9.5 years. Now Flynn has written a memoir telling her side of the story. Her case created a national controversy. Some say it demonstrated that sexism is deeply ingrained in the military. Some say it showed the inherent problems of bringing more women into the military. Others say it showed Flynn's poor judgment and lack of accountability. I asked Flynn what part of her story she thinks has been most misunderstood.
The most misunderstood has been the Air Force's spin that this was not a story about adultery, it was a story about lying and disobeying an order. The fact of the matter is that they shouldn't have been asking me questions about my sex life in the beginning anyway. I lied initially about sex, and I tried to correct the statement with my commanders, but they'd have none of it. And from then on out, it became this case of a disobedient officer, which is far from the truth.
Well, you had an affair with a married man, but he told you that he was separated. He turned out to be what you describe as a pathological liar. I think most people have had some experience falling in love with the wrong person, but what about lying to the military in a sworn statement saying the relationship with him was platonic when it wasn't?
I lied about sex. It was an area where I tried to get myself out of the situation after being asked the most invasive and most humiliating questions I have ever been subject to concerning my sex life, my preferred sexual positions, how many men I've dated, if I had sex with women, and I wanted to get out of the situation. I immediately knew that I had done something wrong and tried to correct it with my commander.
And
he told me that I should go find defense counsel and that he didn't want to hear anything about it because he could be the ultimate hammer. So I was never given the opportunity to rectify the situation, to correct the statement, to correct my mistake.
But maybe he was the wrong person to speak to and you should have found somebody else. Isn't that what he was telling you?
No, my commander was the person that I should be talking to. He was the one that should have been handling this case in the beginning. He's the one that should have sat down and talked to me about it. So it was what happened was the buck just kept getting passed, and no one would sit down and talk to me about this. So what ultimately happened was the media became the courtroom.
A little later on, when your commanding officer gave you a written order directing you to stay at least 100 yards away from Mark Zigo, the man in question, you were, unbeknownst to your commanding officer, living with Zigo, and you continued to live with him after you were given this order to stay at least 100 yards away from him and to cease all contact with him. And then after that, you also took him home to meet your family. Tell me about your rationale there for lying and continuing to do something that you were ordered not to do.
Well, as a matter of fact, let me correct one of the statements that you made first and foremost. You said that my commander was not aware Mark Zigo was living with me, and that is factually incorrect because I have all the surveillance documents that the security police did on my house, which in fact prove that they knew Mark Zigo and myself were living together. The order that was given was factually incorrect. It was unlawful, it was illegal, and it was impossible to obey. The Air Force has no business imposing an order for me not to go home and to go to my bedroom and to go be with whomever I want, especially when they know that person is living in my house, and especially when this woman, his ex-wife, had summoned for divorce on 9 December and had already began the official divorce proceedings 4 days prior to the Air Force giving me an order to stop seeing this man.
Did you ever think that instead of lying that you would kind of make a case about this and say, you know, you are asking me questions that I think you ethically have no right to ask. This is an example of a bad policy in the military that I object to, instead of just lying.
Had I been a little more streetwise and more legal-wise, I probably would have had thought of that. I was called into the security police room for questioning under false pretenses. I was under the impression that was concerning another lieutenant in another case that I testified against him, when in fact it was because this lieutenant was a complainant against me in this new case. So I was there under false pretenses. I was taken by surprise. I was shocked and I was humiliated, and I didn't have my wits about me to think about how I should handle this. Now, in retrospect, hindsight's 20/20. You're absolutely correct. I should have done something along those lines.
But I think what you're talking about was the first time you were asked about whether you were having an affair with this man. What about the second time when you lied about being in contact with him, you know, after you were given the order to stay?
I never lied about that.
You mean you were just given the order and disobeyed it, is what you're saying?
I was given an order that could not be obeyed. I was given an order that set me up. It goes along with the court-martial handbook that they have that says you need to find more ways to, you need to find more charges to go against them, such as false official statements, because it says this is a sure basis for prosecution. What happened with this order was I was called on a Friday evening at approximately 4:30 in the evening to go see my commander. He said, come in whatever you want. So I had my uniform on and went in my uniform. I walked in, he read me my rights, and then he proceeded to read the order to me. He asked if I wanted to say anything, and I said, not without my lawyer present. And then he asked me to sign a statement that acknowledged that I had read the order and that I received a copy of the order. I never said I would obey this order or that I could follow the order. So it was a situation in which all lines of communication were cut off because my commander read me my rights.
Did you talk to your lawyer after this happened and ask for his or her advice?
I sought counsel. I had to call them because they were in Colorado, and it was a Friday evening, and they were not available. I didn't speak with them until the next week after I had to go to my home. The moment I walked out of the office, I disobeyed the order. There was no possible way to obey that order.
What advice did your counsel finally give you?
My counsel said that they'd find some way to handle the order and that eventually I probably should get him out of my life because he was dangerous. I was scared of Mark Zygo. He had threatened to destroy me. He had threatened to destroy my life. He had threatened to kill himself, and he was very unstable, very violent, and I didn't know what he was going to do.
When your commander gave you the order to stop seeing Mark Zygo, to not come within 100 feet of him, and you felt this was an order that was just impossible to obey, what about the order was impossible to obey?
Okay, everything about the order was impossible to obey. First of all, it not only said, do not go within 100 feet of Mark Zygo. It said, do not call Mark Zygo. It said, do not call his work. Do not call his home. Do not try to contact him through a third party. Do not leave a message for him on his answering machine. Do not have any form of communication whatsoever. But the most damaging was, as I just mentioned before, was do not talk to him at all through a third party. So I couldn't even tell my commander to tell Mark Zygo to get out of my house. I couldn't tell my lawyers to tell Mark Zygo to get out of my house because I was disobeying the order if I were to tell anybody to tell Mark Zygo to get out of my house. They broke off every single line of communication that I may have possibly had to tell Mark Zygo to get out of my house unless I were to disobey the order.
When you joined the military, you knew that the military had a different set of rules than civilian life. And by joining, you agreed to follow those rules. So even if you thought some of those rules were unjust, particularly the rules governing private life and sexual conduct, did you feel that it was still your responsibility to obey those rules as a member of the military?
I've always felt it was a responsibility to obey the rules that are out there. Now, the problem lies, and I've also said that I've never thought I should be completely exonerated for breaking a rule or a regulation. I've always said that the punishment should fit the crime, and I made a mistake. And it was an honest mistake, and it wasn't intentional or it wasn't willful. And what was done was, in my opinion, cruel and unusual punishment to make this a public debate. And to humiliate myself, and for the Air Force to do that to me publicly was just reprehensible. And for them to continue to say that this was a case about lying and disobeying is also reprehensible because it started out with them questioning about my consensual sex life. And then it went from there.
What do you think the penalty should have been for your relationship with Mark Zygo?
I think my case should have been handled non-judicially, as almost every other case that has occurred at Minot Air Force Base, whether it be a formal letter of counseling, a letter of reprimand, or an Article 15. This case should never have gone to court. This case should never have been released publicly.
What do you think your penalty should have been for lying under oath to your officer when you told him the relationship was platonic?
I think there really should have been the opportunity to rectify the situation and correct the statement. I think that my commander should have opened the door and let me in and account for my actions of lying. I think the same thing holds true. It should have been the same punishment, because all that kind of runs together. It was the Air Force's way of bringing up more charges so they can have a more severe case against me.
And do you think there should have been a punishment for disobeying the order of not seeing Mark Zygo anymore?
Absolutely not. The order should not have been given in the first place. Well, the question that needs to be asked is, why is the Air Force giving orders to its personnel to stay away from other members and trying to control their personal life, especially when that man had already received copies of his divorce papers? There's no business for the Air Force to be doing that.
Do you think that there should be any rules at all governing the sexual behavior of the military in regards to relationships with other people in the military, or other people who are related to people in the military, or other people who are married at the time of the affair?
I don't think it's anybody's business, especially in militaries, to be imposing rules on how people run their personal and private lives, especially between two consenting adults. And the military, in no way, shape, or form, should be criminalizing these acts. If they're going to handle, if they feel they have to have this need to have control on a personal life, then it should be handled in a non-judicial manner. It should be handled away from the courtrooms, and it should never be made into a felony.
Do you think that there should be no regulations at all about who you can be intimate with within the military?
I think the regulations need to go back to the way they used to be enforced over 200 years ago, when fraternization was defined as some type of influence over another person, or some type of favoritism towards a subordinate. Once women joined, the military in general went completely away from that definition of fraternization and strictly applied it to sex and sex alone. And that needs to stop. It needs to go back to the original way that fraternization was defined, as favoritism.
My guest is Kelly Flynn. She's written a new memoir called Proud to Be. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Kelly Flynn is my guest, and she's written a memoir about her case in the military and about her training in the Air Force called Proud to Be: My Life, the Air Force, the Controversy. As the first woman bomber pilot, you were likely to be carefully watched and used as a role model and a public relations opportunity for the military, and it was probable that people would be watching your every step, and I'm wondering if that ever affected your behavior.
Oh, it most certainly affected my behavior. I knew my every move was being watched for the longest time. If anything, I studied a lot longer and a lot harder than I ever had before. I worked hard at my job. I made sure my boots were shined as bright as they could be every day. I would not socialize with members of the squadron. And it totally affected. I isolated myself from everybody.
Oh, how did that affect your choice in men?
Well, it limited it, especially. I didn't really have a whole choice, since I decided that I wasn't going to date anyone within my squadron or within my unit, because I didn't want to date inside the fishbowl and have the possibility of flying with the person I was dating or may have broken up with. So the dating pool was very limited, and I found a civilian who was interested in me, who told me he was legally separated, had filed for divorce, and that it was perfectly fine to date him.
Mark Zygo, you describe as a pathological liar, and he lied to you in saying, you say that that he was virtually separated from his wife. They weren't. They were still living together, and you found that out when you paid a visit to his house. You also found out that his wife was actually in the military, making things really raising the stakes for you. But you continued to see him when you realized that he was lying to you and that you were in a much more dangerous situation. So should you perhaps have extricated yourself from the relationship then?
I tried to on several occasions to extradite myself from the situation. Let me first say that when Mark and I met his wife and went to the house, they were married, and Mark had no story whatsoever about being separated or divorced. That story came later. A few days later or weeks later on the timeline, after I returned from a trip to Atlanta, that he was now separated and he had filed for divorce and would be divorced on December 20th, and that the relationship was okay. I was in a clinically defined abusive relationship, and I tried on several times to get out of it. The man threatened me, the man pushed me, and the man was abusive to me both physically and emotionally. I needed help, and I didn't get it, and I didn't seek help initially when I should have, and that was my mistake in doing so, but it was also a mistake of the Air Force in not offering some help, too.
But what you're saying now is that you started the relationship with him when you knew he was still married.
No, I started the relationship with him when he told me he was legally separated and that he had filed for divorce.
But then when you saw that they were living together, you knew that they weren't legally separated.
No, I did not know anything of the sort. I was told by Mark Zygo that he was legally separated. They were living in separate bedrooms until the divorce was final.
Getting back to the idea of you as the first woman bomber pilot in the Air Force being this kind of role model and public relations opportunity, were there times that you felt most of all that you were being watched? I mean, before you were called out on your affair.
Well, from the moment that I selected the B-52 and found out that I had earned some title along with it, the first female B-52 pilot, from that moment on, I knew I was being watched. My first flight in a B-52, I flew with a colonel, a squadron commander. And then from then on, once I arrived at Minot, there were times when I just flew with a colonel after colonel after colonel, and everybody was, you know, wanted to fly with me for some reason. I couldn't figure out why I couldn't just fly with my aircraft commander or captain. Why did I always have to have colonels on board? I was watched all the time.
And what impact did that have on you? Did you like that? Did you feel honored by the attention?
No, I hated the attention. It was very frustrating because I tried to blend in. I tried to be one of the guys, but you really can't blend in when you've got the Air Force sticking you out there saying, look, this is a woman flying the B-52. And then when I'm walking around having camera crews following me everywhere, I'm walking around and I have colonels following me everywhere, and none of the men do. It's tough to blend in. It makes you even more lonely and more isolated than you really are.
How did you become the first woman to fly a B-52?
It was by luck. At the end of pilot training, what happens is the Air Force has, say, 20 available airplanes to choose from, and there are 20 students, and you pick based on your ranking at the end of pilot training. And I was in the middle of my class, and that was the available combat aircraft that I wanted, so that's what I picked.
Were there ways that you thought the Air Force wasn't really prepared for women?
I think that the military in general wasn't really prepared for women, and the fact that the way they handled it, I can see how it's difficult because a lot of women have different views on how to handle their job, and just as we have different opinions on how to get equality. I think there's a point now that the military has to stop looking at women as just people who are the opposite sex and who get involved in sexual relationships with members in the military. They need to start looking at women as an asset, as people who can do the job, as other professionals.
There are some ways, just really practical ways, that you thought it was difficult for a woman. And I'm talking about, for instance, the uniforms that women wore. Were those uniforms sized for men?
The uniforms that we wore as cadets, the first thing I noticed was during basic training, I was issued a very huge, large pair of underwear that they were huge. They went pretty much all the way up to my chest, and we had to shove them in these really short shorts. So in that area, they definitely weren't sized to fit women. But there are other areas, too. The uniforms were not very flattering. If you gained even a quarter of an inch on your waist, everybody knew about it and everybody talked about it. The uniforms that are still issued today, I can tell you I still have about 6 or 7 pair of long underwear, Nomex long underwear for flying that I was issued. It's all men's long underwear. And that's all they issue women now is men's long underwear. I think it's time that they can probably start to focus on the women and realize that we wear women's long underwear too. And my flight gloves never fit, so yeah.
I don't know if you feel like going into this or not, but there seemed to be no facility for dealing with a woman having to relieve herself when flying a B-52.
It's pretty funny. That was one of the issues that was highly discussed, and the questions that people wanted to know was how I went to the bathroom on the B-52. And they did some modification. They tried to build these curtains around it, and it didn't work out, so I made a special modification and bought something out of a flying magazine. But no, they weren't really prepared. But the women had been flying on B-52s for a while. There were women crew chiefs who went for rides on B-52s before. So it's a fact of life, and I think men in the military have to accept that women are here to stay.
What's it like to fly a B-52?
Oh, it's one of the most wonderful experiences. The B-52 is unlike any other plane that's out there. It's aerodynamically different. It's very huge, and it's lumbering, but it's extremely graceful. And you have to anticipate its moves so much because it's like a big, huge ball of inertia that's out there that you're trying to control.
What about flying in formation? What does that feel like, and what did you like about that?
Well, flying in formation is different for each aircraft, and flying in formation in the training planes, the smaller planes, is one of the most exciting experiences I've ever done. Flying in a T-38, which is a small, sleek, jet-like aircraft, we'd fly approximately 3 feet from our buddy off their wing, and we're going about, I don't know, 400 to 500 miles per hour through the sky. And it's a rush. It takes a lot of concentration, though, and it takes a lot of effort. But once you get it, it's one of the most graceful things I think that's ever done.
What impact do you think your case is going to have on the future of women in the Air Force? Any ideas?
Well, I'd like to think that my case isn't just going to impact women. I hope that it's going to impact men in the military, too. I'd like to think that I'm going to be a catalyst for change, especially in regards to the judicial system and the consensual sex rules, and that the military will find some type of reform and create a better and stronger environment for the people who are working in it.
Kelly Flynn, her new memoir is called Proud to Be. We'll hear from Brigadier General William Moorman in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.